everybody, and welcome to the Sauce Perspective, where there is not a theme today, because if I make a theme, Trevor is going to make a snippy, snarky comment and get a little upset about it. And before anybody says, well, hey, Don, isn't that kind of a theme? I know. I'm aware. I'm your host, Don Sauce, and this is my co-host, Trevor Sauce.
Oh, you beat me to my own punt, my own joke, Don. I was going to make fun of the fact that it was a theme. Ugh.
Oh, what can I say? I'm a Jedi.
A Jedi? I don't know about that.
I just use the Jedi. I guess Jedi mind trick doesn't let you read people's mind. It just lets you change people's mind. So I guess I'm not a Jedi. I'm I don't know what I am. A nerd, I suppose. Okay, on that note, Trevor, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how the podcast is set up?
Okay. Well, we'll break the podcast into three distinct segments. The first segment, called Digging Deep, is where Don suggests a movie to watch. I go out of my way to watch it, and then we converge back. Usually this movie is underrated or unknown, sometimes not, such as today's movie.
Today's movie is not underappreciated, and it isn't unknown. Although I would say it's probably underseen by people our age.
Well, you keep making the argument for a lot of movies we watch.
And I think it's a fair argument. I don't think young people watch old movies.
I don't think the majority of our generation does, but I think there's a large portion that does.
Don't get me wrong. There definitely are people that watch old films. And, if you like, it's a matter of, are you a casual film goer that goes to see, the newest Michael Bay action movie and the newest fucking Kevin Hart shitty comedy? Or are you the kind of person that watches good movies? If you watch the good new movies, then yeah, you watch old movies. If you watch the shitty new movies, you probably don't watch old movies. And that made me come off as really snobby.
It really did. I was like, way to disenfranchise, all the potential casual listeners we have.
I don't think that's true, though. I don't think that our listeners are the type that go out of their way to go see fucking Ride Along at the theaters.
You're assuming know our audience. I don't know our audience. The audience doesn't interact with us very much, so.
That's true. Well, I'm going to say that, then. If you're watching us talk about, fucking Ran or, Das Boot, I feel like you have decent taste in cinema.
The second segment.
And on that note, right, the next segment.
Is this week's Hot Sauce is where we go out of our way to talk about something new that catches our attention. That can be movies, TV, video games, music, cultural events. If we catch our attention, we're going to talk about it. And then lastly, the secret sauce is a free-flowing conversation where Don and I talk about other items and our current litany of, I don't know, it's just a conversation we have.
It really is. We try and provide some structure to it, but at the end of the day, it just becomes Trevor and I having a back-and-forth repartee. And on that note, I suppose I should tell everybody what we're talking about this week.
That could potentially help. Maybe one time we shouldn't tell them. We just dive into it. Yeah.
We just dive right in? Yeah. So this is the third week of our Digging Deep series, where we're talking about films before actors and actresses were well-known. We were going to be talking about All the Real Girls from director David Gordon Green, who made Pineapple Express. So it's also a case of a director before he was famous. Starring Zoe Deschanel, back when nobody knew who she was. She hadn't even made Elf yet. But because of President's Day, Netflix didn't even ship the movie to me till this morning. I'm saying it hasn't even been shipped till today.
Yeah, mine was supposed to get here today, and we had a pretty significant snowstorm yesterday, so I did not have it still.
Right, same. So we'll be talking about it next week. It does thankfully appear then that both Trevor and I will have it next week, because my copy's on the way, as is his.
Yeah.
So instead, we're talking about what was supposed to be the last film that we were going to watch for this segment, Annie Hall, from director Woody Allen, and I chose it because this was the film that made Diane Keaton a star. She won the Best Actress Academy Award at the 1976 Academy Awards, and this film won a host of Oscars, Best Picture and Best Director, notably and notoriously beating Star Wars for Best Picture. But I'm going to have a whole rant about how if you think Star Wars A New Hope is a better film than Annie Hall, you need to have your head checked. you can enjoy it more, but Annie Hall is a better film. That's another conversation for that part of the podcast. For this week's Hot Sauce, Trevor and I are going to be talking about the second episode of Telltale's Game of Thrones series, and I've already forgotten the name of the episode.
The Lost Lords.
The Lost Lord. That's appropriate. Because that applies to, like, two different people in this episode.
Well, it's Lost Lords. It's multiple lords.
Oh, is it lords? There we go. So that's even more appropriate then. And for the secret sauce, I might have a little bit to say about Broad City, which I have devoured. Trevor might talk a little bit about Ken Burns' The Civil War, as well as Thor the Dark World. And also the 40th anniversary special of Saturday Night Live, which I watched last night. And on that note, we're going to jump right into digging deep with Annie Hall. Trevor, I already know the answer to this question. Did you enjoy Annie Hall?
Well, this is my second viewing of it. My first viewing was with you in your dorm. I don't know which year it was. I think it might have been freshman year.
Freshman.
Actually. Yeah.
It was the first semester of freshman year.
Okay, there you go. You know exactly when. I thought it was your freshman year because the dorm room itself was in the corner. So. How I remember it, because I physically remember the location.
Well, there you go. As long as you remember it somehow.
And so it's that was freshman year of college. Oh my god, Don, that was so long ago.
2007, not quite 6.5 years ago.
Oh wow. Wow, that just made me feel.
Hold
really
up.
Old.
No, it was. It's more than seven. 7.5 years ago. I'm really bad at math.
It's okay. So my memory of it was limited, but I put it on. This evening when I got home from work, because it's a short film, luckily.
Yeah, it's only an hour and a half long.
Yeah, exactly. So I was in no rush to watch it once I found out that's what we were watching. And I did enjoy it. It is a good movie. I just feel it's outdated.
It's what?
I think it's outdated.
Well, we're going to talk about that. The idea that it's hard to appreciate Annie Hall for what Annie Hall was in 1977, because it basically became a template for a certain type of film. There's this constant competition among romantic comedies to be the next Annie Hall, and there are a lot of films that kind of take its style, but we'll definitely have that discussion. So before I talk about, clearly I enjoy Annie Hall. I've probably said this on the podcast, but this is my favorite movie, like, of all time. Although, I think I've finally seen it too many times. Annie Hall is one of those movies, like The Big Lebowski, that I watch at least twice a year, wow, if not more. It centers me, I suppose. And it's usually one of those films where I feel like I pick up something new every time. This time, the only new thing that I picked up was, like, one little random bit of the background in a scene that I thought was ridiculously clever, but I'll go on into that in more detail later. So for anybody who hasn't seen Annie Hall, it is a highly, highly autobiographical romantic comedy written and directed by and also starring Woody Allen, made in 1977, that is basically a film about his real-life relationship with Diane Keaton, who plays the titular Annie Hall. And Annie Hall is Diane Keaton's real name. A lot of people don't know that, but that's actually her birth name is Annie Hall. And it's a non-linear, fourth-wall-shattering examination of romance and what it means. What are the limits of romance? What are the things that cause romances to fail? What are the things that we as men do that drive these wedges in relationships and intimacy? And it's really kind of this excoriation of male neuroses. And it's hard to describe the plot of Annie Hall. And it's a story about their relationship. It's about a neurotic comedian in New York City dating a somewhat ditzy girl from Wisconsin, and all the various ways that their love is doomed to fail. I hope it's not a spoiler alert that they don't end up together.
I mean, the movie was made in 1977. It's older than we are.
Right. Yeah, if you haven't seen Annie Hall yet, I'm sorry, but this is Annie Hall is kind of the first of the anti-romantic comedies, which is to say that it's a film about it's the entire film is about the ways in which romances don't work out and the things that cause them to fail. So I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the main central romance in the movie disintegrates spectacularly before the film is over. Okay, Trevor. Well, before you talk about, you know, the ways in which you found the film to be dated, what is it that you enjoy about Annie Hall?
This is might be the only time I can say I enjoy Woody Allen for being Woody Allen. He's funny. He's genuinely funny in this movie, and I think it's because he's so self-deprecating that it's hard not to laugh with him about that's actually jokes are about him.
Right. So people accuse Woody Allen of being like this you know, crazy narcissist.
Well, he is.
He is. But you know, this crazy narcissist who can't joke about himself, that he's so self-serious and pretentious. But you know, he is pretentious and he is a narcissist. But I don't know how you can watch Annie Hall and not think that this guy is more than willing to make tons and tons and tons of jokes about what an asshole he can be.
And there's lots of them. And I enjoy him breaking, I enjoy him breaking the fourth wall and acknowledging that we're watching it. And that's probably at the time was, you know, revolutionary almost.
This is one of those things where context is really important. Woody Allen started his career out making from the end of the 1960s to the beginning of the 70s. He's made a film in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 20s. He's made movies in 6 decades. When Woody Allen's career started out, he started out making like screwball, slapstick, kind of like raunchy comedies. But Woody Allen, as a film lover, he always loved like art house foreign cinema, Fellini, Bergman, Truffaut, Godard, etc., etc. And he always felt kind of restrained by the conventions of American cinema that, you know, the fourth wall must be maintained, linearity must be maintained, consistency in tone and style must be maintained. And Annie Hall was the first of his films where he really kind of let loose and showed, you know, that, hey, there's a place for all of these European art house stylistic flourishes in mainstream American cinema.
Well, other things I enjoy about this movie, there's some unique insights here, and I think that's also where it's a little outdated as well. Some of the things are still true. What I feel like he fails to do is acknowledge, well, maybe he is acknowledging it, he's acknowledging it by making the movie, but in the movie himself, I don't think he acknowledges it.
Acknowledges what?
That he's causing all of this himself. He's the reason.
I think he does acknowledge it in the movie. I think the whole movie is about how all of his relationship problems are his fault.
I guess at the end, the ending he doesn't.
That whole so, Woody Allen, the filmmaker, is acknowledging these things. Alvy Singer, the character, isn't necessarily acknowledging all these things.
That's what I'm getting at. The movie itself is an acknowledgement of his failures in relationships.
Right.
But I don't think Alfie...
I think that's what makes the film kind of honest, though. we don't like to admit when we're the one that's fucking up. And so the film, one of the second to last scene in the movie before you have that closing monologue about the chicken and or the crazy guy and that chicken and the eggs, as you know, Woody and Diane Keaton have their final meeting. You have that scene where he's putting on a play, and it's like this terrible fan fiction version of all the events that have happened in the movie beforehand. And I think that's specifically an acknowledgement of the way that we as men want to not take the blame for when relationships fail. That, you know, we want to blame the woman every time. And, you know, I'm the first person, you know, to say that I mean, Christine was literally crazy, but I shouldn't have said her name like that. One of my exes.
You say it all the time. You try avoiding her name, and then you just drop the name in the middle of the story every time you talk about her.
That's true. I mean, she's not literally. My ex isn't literally crazy. She had issues for, like, legitimate reasons. But I'm also selfish. I'm the first person on the planet to admit that I'm selfish. But when our relationship was ending, I didn't necessarily want to acknowledge it, the fact that I'm selfish and I can be emotionally distant, what role that might have played in, you know, our relationship ending, or what role, you know, my... I have this thing where I intentionally don't get very close with people, or I try my best to not get super close with people, so that way, if for some reason, whatever relationship I have with that person, whether it be romantic or friendship, when it inevitably ends, I don't get hurt. And this all relates to my relationship with my mother. But even I don't like to admit that it's my fault for, you know, not going that extra mile to try and solidify friendships with people. So I think that whole sequence at the end of the film is basically an acknowledgement of and kind of it's one of the whole points of Annie Hall, is that we create these fantasies for ourselves. About whatever role we've played in some disaster in our life. But maybe that's just me.
He's making some good points, but I think part of the issue that I'm having with the general thought here is, and I think this is part of the reason why I think it's outdated, it's falling into these general male stereotypes that we have to think this way. And I think 40 years later, our society doesn't think that way as much anymore. It's not our generation. I think our generation thinks about ourselves differently.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, certainly. There are definitely elements of the film that are very much rooted in 1970s New York. I'm Jewish, so I feel comfortable saying this. And like 1970s New York, nebbish Jewish stereotypes. But that's just Woody Allen. That's just kind of who he is, and I think that's kind of who he is to this day. Although without the young parts, but the elements of the film that come off as dated to me are. You know, there are specific elements of the story. I don't know how to say this. There are elements of the story, individual building blocks of characters and the conflicts that might be dated, but I think the nature of the conflicts themselves are still things that we deal with now. There's a quote from Annie Hall that is literally the second thing on my OKCupid profile. I'll bring it up right now. Because I think it's so true, and I think it speaks to a very specific mindset that a lot of neurotic intellectual guys still have. All right, here's the joke from Annie Hall. There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, in such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life. Full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly. The other important joke for me is one that's usually attributed to Groucho Marx, but I think it appears originally in Freud's Wit and its relation to the unconscious. And it goes like this. I'm paraphrasing. I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member. I think that there's a lot of what the film is about, besides the ways in which that we, you know, create these fantasies and rationalizations and excuses for why relationships fail and why, you know, we failed to form meaningful connections with other people, is that it's also a film about, you know, a pathological... a pathological self-loathing, and if not a pathological self-loathing, a pathological sort of lack of self-confidence. That we have so much trouble accepting the flaws and shortcomings in ourselves that if somebody else is able to accept the flaws and shortcomings in us, it makes us really sort of question the intellectual or moral or ethical validity of the person that's wanting to be with us. And so, yeah, there are elements of Woody's flaws in the film that are very much rooted in the 1970s. Hints of some casual misogyny, although not nearly to the extent of the fucking douchebags from Swingers. You know, there's that. There's the... How do I say this? A lot of the concerns about commitment and relationships in general, you know, and labels and all that stuff. Although that, I would say, is still very much a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Commitment and labeling of a relationship is still significant, but that's something that's not going to go away. I think that's just the nature of human beings. But I don't know, like, all his sexual hang-ups and all these those type of issues aren't... See, here's another issue. You kept saying we, as if it's universal. I couldn't relate with Woody Allen at all because I don't think like Woody Allen.
Well, and that's fair. So what I'm saying is...
I mean, you think like Woody Allen a lot more than I do. I was like, this is reminds me a little bit of Dawn, except not as... Woody Allen is a lot more pretentious than you are and a lot more narcissistic than you are, but you have both of those qualities. And
yeah, so no, here's the thing. So it's not that the film is dated, it's that... elements of it are, but that's just because it... You know, it fucking came out in 1977. Of course, certain parts of it are dated. It's that in order to, like, there's a reason why Annie Hall is, like, my favorite film, and your favorite film is something like Shawshank, right? Is it still Shawshank?
I haven't seen anything that surpassed it yet, so.
Okay, well, there you go.
Das Boot's really good. It's probably, Das Boot is probably in my favorites now, but I don't know if it's past Shawshank.
Right. So what the point that I was trying to make there, though, is that Annie Hall speaks to my worldview, and not necessarily that everybody is like that, but I think for those who are particularly introspective. Jesus fucking Christ. For those that are particularly oh my God. Why is this word so hard to say? Introspective. I think there's an element of this film that just it hits right at the core of everything that we fear about in ourselves. So when you watch Annie Hall, I hope to God nobody watches Annie Hall and wants to be fucking Alvy Singer. If you watch this movie and you want to be Alvy, you're as dumb as the people that watch The Wolf of Wall Street and want to be Jordan Belfort. Annie Hall is all about... It's like a roadmap for people that, you know, have a lot of the same character flaws that Alvy has in this film. It's a roadmap on how to avoid those issues in yourself. It's kind of like how in Chasing Amy. Chasing Amy is alongside 500 Days of Summer... To me, one of the only true heirs to Annie Hall, because it's a film about the things that we do as men that are fucking awful, and, you know, what we can do to be better, but also a recognition that for a lot of us, that terribleness is inside us. but we have a responsibility to be better than that. And that's why one of the reasons why I don't understand why people get really upset, like that the people that find Jason Amy to be homophobic are people that find Annie Hall to be some type of misogynistic picture, when Annie Hall, the film is more empathetic towards Diane Keaton's character than anybody else in the film. The film is like is nothing but this, like, you know, very positive picture of a flawed and very complicated woman, but, you know, her actions are logical. She's never going out of her way to hurt anybody. Whereas Alvy is shallow and spiteful and so in his own head that he can't ever be with the person that he's with. And so I guess what I think is that Annie Hall is a film about not being that guy, made by a man who knows that he can be that person but doesn't want to be that person. Can we talk about how good Diane Keaton is in this?
She was very good.
Yeah, she won the. I mean, she won the Oscar for the film. I think it was. I think it's her only.
But she was playing
her
herself.
Only
so
Academy.
Does that count?
Wait, what?
She's playing her. Does that count?
She is like literally playing herself. That definitely
is that acting.
Helps
is like,
things.
Is that really acting?
I think it is. Because Joey Lauren Adams was basically playing herself in Chasing Amy.
True.
And she gives the best performance in Chasing Amy. We've been talking about this for almost half an hour now. And I really want to talk about Game of Thrones, too. We can't talk about Annie Hall, and we can't talk about any Woody Allen movie without saying, you know, there's a really healthy chance that Woody Allen's a terrible, monstrous human being. However, you also can't talk about the history of American cinema without talking about his films. And it's those aren't, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Those aren't mutually exclusive statements that he is both probably a terrible, terrible person and also probably one of the most important filmmakers our country ever produced. And I get bothered by people that are unable to understand that there's a difference between somebody's art and the person that made the art. And there's a difference between the historical context of an art and the person that made the art. So that's
for
me
people
subtweeting.
That can't understand Woody Allen. That today's modern day equivalent would probably be like Kanye West.
No, not even like that.
Oh well, no.
I'm not talking about like
the degree of hatred and misunderstanding. Woody Allen is questioned some questionable. Woody Allen has a really questionable history. Kanye doesn't.
It's not even fair. Like, don't get me wrong. It's funny that you brought up Kanye West because I just wrote an article about him. But like Kanye, people don't like Kanye because he's an asshole. People don't like. There are people that don't like Woody Allen because there's a chance he raped somebody.
Yeah, like the reasons for not liking Woody Allen are legitimate reasons not like him.
Well, like so, like there are legitimate reasons to dislike things that Kanye West does.
Oh yeah, no, I know.
But there are way more legitimate reasons to dislike Woody Allen. But if you're talking about the history of American comedy, and you don't talk about Woody Allen's earliest films, you are engaging in an act of intellectual dishonesty that is so staggering it boggles the mind. Because American comedy does not enter the modern age until Woody Allen makes his first film. If Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, you know, if they're the kings of early, you know, silent American comedy, and people like Howard Hawks and Preston Sturges are the kings of, not just the kings, the fathers of, you know, the beginning of the talkie era of Hollywood comedy. Nobody shaped what American comedy became more than Woody Allen did in the 1960s and 70s. You just can't. You can't not talk about his films. I'm sorry. it's for the same reason that you can't not talk about Roman Polanski, despite the fact that he was charged, and I believe that he was charged with statutory rape and fled the country for having sex with a 15 or a 16-year-old or something like that. You can't not talk about the guy who fucking made Chinatown, which is, you know, consistently ranked among the top 10 films in the English language ever made. And it will definitely be something that we talk about on the podcast at some point. You know, I would love to live in this fantasy world where all art of meaning is made by people that are perfect and have nothing that could sully their, you know, their artistic output. But that's not the real world. Sorry, somebody accused me on Twitter of being a rape apologist because I said Woody Allen was a great filmmaker. In the same fucking tweet that I also said, he's probably a monster. So I'm a little salty about it.
Well, because some people just cannot separate them, Don. They just can't.
That's fine, and if they don't want to separate it, good for them. But if you want to imply that somebody is a bad guy because he can, fuck off forever and grow up, you child. And on that note, let's move on to Trevor. Should our viewers watch Annie Hall?
Yeah, it's a fun movie. Even though, yeah, you really don't like Woody Allen afterwards, that's for sure. But it's a good movie. You should watch it. Yeah.
Right. It's the best. I mean, it's my favorite movie ever. No movie did more to shape my worldview than Annie Hall. And on that note, we're going to move on to Game of Thrones. And Trevor, I'm going to let you take lead.
Again? I'm gonna have to start writing these out ahead of time, you know, like prep for the show more.
I don't do any prep.
Neither do I. But my openings are usually like straight to the point and exact and really boring. Well, okay, fine. The second episode of the Telltale's Game of Thrones, called The Lost Lords, takes us right to where we left. Well, not exactly where we left off, but it brings us back into the world of Westeros, dealing with the Forsters, the Forsters family, I guess would be the appropriate way to say that. And the tragic loss of both their head of the house and then the presumed next head of the house from the death of Edric? Ethan? Is Ethan?
Ethan.
Yeah, Ethan Forrester. And it throws us back into this chaotic world. And, I mean, usually with these, we just usually talk about what we did and the story in general. Is that how we want to...
Right, but before we do that, I want to... I guess I'll jump in now.
You always say I'll jump in. Just jump in. Don't have to tell us that you're jumping in.
That's fair, I suppose. I like this episode a lot more than the first one. I think it's because all of the people that I was playing as seemed way more interesting than, like, you get to play as two different people in this one than you did in the first one. Mostly because one of the people that you were playing as in the first one is dead. That would be Ethan.
Who's the other one?
Roderick and Asher. Did you not get to play as Asher?
Asher is the abandoned,
that's the one that's in Yunkai.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Roderick.
Did you not get to play as Roderick? You had to have.
Roderick, wait.
Roderick is the older brother. You didn't play as him in the first one.
I didn't even think about the fact that he's a new character, because he was in the first episode. Okay. Yeah, okay. I was like, what is he talking about, him being new? I was so confused. Okay, you're right. Okay.
Okay, thanks. Asher seems awesome. Like, I already want... Well, the thing about Asher is I would much rather play as the girl that's part of Asher's group, but I get why we're playing as Asher, because this is about the Forrester family, minus Garrett Tuttle, who I'm still not convinced isn't a bastard or something. But I just this episode, like, the pacing felt better all around. The choices didn't necessarily seem as difficult as the first game, although there were a couple interesting ones for sure. Just all around, this one felt less like really bad George R.R. Martin fan fiction, which is what the first one felt like to me. Fun George R.R. Martin fan fiction, but not like really well-written fan fiction. This was like, you know, mid-tier fan fiction. This one felt like a lot of fun. It was really good. I really enjoyed it, except for one thing. Maybe it was just because I was playing it on the PS4, but the visual aesthetic for the Game of Thrones series is that it's like, for Telltale, is that it's like this watercolor thing, and it looks terrible to begin with. Like, we discussed that last time.
Yeah.
It does not have the like stylistic cohesiveness that the comic book style offered for The Walking Dead or for A Wolf Among Us. I just kind of think it looks like shit. But Trevor, maybe this was just a PS4 problem, because I know you were playing it on the PS3,
no,
at least I assume.
I had serious issues with not only the visuals, but also with loading time and repetitive audio.
That only happened to me during the our next episode thing.
No, that happened to me throughout the whole thing. Every time
I did not have
scene,
the repetitive
audio problem. It would basically repeat the first few lines.
That would have driven me nuts.
Oh my god, it really took me out of this episode because it happened all of the time. So my enjoyment of this episode wasn't as good as yours, and I think that's because of the experience of the game itself was just jittery.
Okay, so because it's super fucking glitchy. Well then, did you also have the problem where you had like this really, really like muddy texture bleeding?
No, and that's probably the difference between the systems there.
Yeah, so my problem was that, like, so on the one hand, the things that are far away are supposed to look really kind of out of focus, and like, and it's supposed to look like this really like abstract watercolor painting, and it like worked sort of when you had that really like far away shot of King's Landing. It looked okay there, but when you're like looking at things that are up close and it looks like a river that's like melting, it doesn't look good. And it was constantly taking me out of the experience in like this really bad way. And I didn't notice a ton of glitches in The Walking Dead. I don't remember a bunch. I mean, I remember a handful. But, you know, there weren't a ton of glitches in The Walking Dead. And I don't remember really any major glitches in A Wolf Among Us, although I only played the first episode. I need to get around to playing it, because I actually liked it more than I liked The Walking Dead, and I fucking love The Walking Dead. You should play The Wolf Among Us, Trevor. It's like a noir. It's so good. It's like a noir fairy tale. a really dark noir deconstruction of fairy tales. But, yeah, there were problems all over the place with this episode. And that's a shame, because I really think they upped the writing in this episode, and they upped the intensity of the action in this episode. So let's go ahead and just like move on to the story itself then. So Trev, the game starts out in Yunkai.
Yes, as you play as Asher, yeah.
You play as Asher along with his I think she's a lesbian sellsword, Beksha. As his uncle, whose name I've forgotten, Malcolm, maybe.
I don't recall his uncle either.
Here was a problem that I did not have with The Walking Dead. I never had much trouble remembering everything from The Walking Dead. I had a lot of readjusting to what the hell happened in the first episode of this when I played the second episode.
I think
episode.
This is because it's very much like Game of Thrones in terms of there's a bunch of characters not together doing things.
Right. This story is spread out throughout the fucking entirety of not just Westeros now, but
yeah, when Yunkai
goddamn
now. Yeah.
Yeah, we're on the other continent.
We're in the Free Cities.
Yeah.
The irony of that statement, but yes, the Free Cities.
We're going to be seeing I bet we'll see Dany in one of these episodes now. That feels like an inevitability.
Actually, that's one of my biggest like issues with the series is all these like cameos from the main characters. I'm like, why bother? Why bother?
on the one hand, I thought it distracted in the first one. For the most part, I think it kind of worked this time. The moment with Jon Snow and Garrett Tuttle in the elevator, for example, I thought that worked. Because not only is it revealing a little bit about, you know, Garrett, we're seeing a side of Jon that we don't get to see very often even in the books or the show, which is Jon interacting with another Northman. And, you know, seeing Jon's frustration, you know, kind of like, because, you know, when Jon's at the wall, he has to be very careful about what he does and who he talks about his real feelings with, because he's a member of the Night's Watch. He has to be neutral. But with Garrett, you know, he can be very upfront about how furious he is about what Ramsay Snow did to Robb. I mean, let's face it, Jon's a way more interesting character than Robb ever was. So that didn't bother me. The Margaery stuff with Mira isn't working for me so much. But then the Tyrion stuff is. So, and I think those were the only three cameos this episode. Was Margaery, Tyrion, and...
Yep, and Jon.
And Jon. So, which is, it's a shame that I don't feel like they're giving Margaery enough stuff to do, because I love Natalie Dormer as Margaery anyways. That's one of the improvements I would say that the show has made over the books, which is giving that character actual depth. But so you start out in Yun Kai as Asher, who is the son of the is he the eldest son of the Forrester clan?
No, he's the second. Roderick's older.
So he wouldn't, there's no concern about succession then. That's good. Okay. So you have the second eldest son of the Forrester clan forced to leave the North because he fell in love with the daughter of the rival house, the White Hills, the fucking douchey McDouche family. And it's about him and his sellsword lady friend escaping Yun Kai because the Lost Legion, which is a group of sellswords, want to kill him for some reason. I mean, whatever, you got to take part in a really awesome bar fight. And then that's that introduction to him. Like, oh, okay. So here's this guy who's now trying to get back to Westeros with an army to win, to, like, help save his family. And I'm like, okay, well, that's cool. Like, that immediately set a better tone for the episode for me. I don't know about you.
No, that was one of the better storylines in this one was Asher. Unfortunately, we don't get to see much of him.
No, he only appeared in two segments.
Which feels like Danny in the first few seasons. You only get to see Danny every... Well, particularly the second season.
Right. And then, the next bit is... Is the next person that you play as, is it Roderick or is it Garrett?
I want to say it's Roderick.
Right. So then you find out that the actual heir to the house, who everybody thought had died at the Battle of the Twins, like, you just assumed he was dead for good reason... is alive. Kind of a silly twist, but I like Roderick as a character. He seems like he has potential to not just be like Robb Part 2. Because the problem that Trevor and I pointed out last time is that all of the characters on this show feel like such obvious stand-ins for Starks.
They still do.
Yeah, they still do to an extent, but I don't know. I feel like this episode was really when they began to distinguish themselves a little bit. And one of the things that I'm liking about this episode, and that I like about The Walking Dead, is that the Telltale Game of Thrones games don't feel like a power fantasy at all. Because you're basically... It almost feels like a survival game. Like a game where you do... whatever the fuck you can to stay alive. And you're not, you know, blasting enemies away. You're not conquering all of Westeros. You know, you're not going to be the best. Your, like, literal goal is to take what meager resources you have and not get crushed by the, you know, Machiavellian machinations of Westeros. So I appreciated that about it, and you know, all of the Roderick stuff really hit that home, because he's half crippled. The White Hills have taken almost all of his family's land, and by the end of the episode, they decide to take all of it. I don't know if that happened for you.
We'll get to that eventually.
Okay, so, well, what's the first, like, actual, I mean, and then, you know, the other major storyline of the episode, because I think
there's
you
two
only,
storylines there.
There's two others left, right, is, you know, Garrett being trained at the wall.
Yeah.
And Mira just, once again, trying to navigate the treacherous waters of King's Landing.
Yep. Well, the first major decision deals with Mira and the writing of Margie's letters. It's
I did not forge
it.
A letter.
Huh?
I did not forge it.
I didn't either. I didn't think it was worth losing the little bit of trust I already had with Margie over a stupid letter when I had the opportunity. I knew the opportunity would come later to potentially save the marriage.
Well, let's talk about that then. So, Trev, you and I brought this up on Twitter this like late last night / this morning when I was playing it. You and I are both tabletop role players.
Yeah.
You know, you've played, you know, Pathfinder for years with your brother, and I played Dungeons and Dragons a lot in middle school and some in college. Do you role play each Forester how you would think that Forester would react? Or do you try and do it with an overall scheme in mind for, like are you engaging in a lot of metagaming? What's your method for how you make these decisions in this game?
That's interesting. I don't think I'm... There's too many characters for me to play them each individually. It'd just be really hard for me, I think, to try to treat each one of these as a unique person when I'm controlling all of them. So it's almost like I'm treating them as a beehive of characters that relate to what I want to happen.
Okay, see, and I try and ask myself, in the limit, like, you know, the one thing about these games, and that's one of the things that I like, is that you aren't given an infinite amount of time to make a decision. You know, you
sometimes
have...
Sometimes not enough times, because that's one of my issues with this game, is sometimes the timing is way too quick. I'm like, I didn't even chance to read all of them. Like, fuck.
Oh, I guess I don't have that problem. I definitely don't have a chance to read all of them. I don't have a chance to think super clearly about all of them.
And the the actual actions in this game... I hate that too.
See, it didn't bother me this time. Like I liked the way it played, I suppose.
Yeah, but it has like it just like, oh, an arrow pops up, but I'm so busy watching it that I like, oh crap, I'm in the wrong way because I didn't realize the arrow was pointing the other direction. And how many times I died in the first scene because I just, oh, I missed the trigger button. I missed the trigger button and not get I just hate that type of style because it makes you react.
You're not. I mean, well, you know, quick time events are definitely a not for everybody thing. There was that period in the PS2, you know, GameCube era where after Resident Evil 4 came out, like every game on the planet became all about them quick time events. You know, LA Noir. Heavy Rain is just one massive quick time event. It's quick time event the game. Although I like Heavy Rain a lot. I know that's not a popular thing to say, but I really enjoy that game. So that's fair. You don't have to like it. I do. I only died once, and it was in that first scene. But I can definitely see where that takes some getting accustomed to. But I'm playing this differently than I play The Walking Dead. Like when I play The Walking Dead, you know, Clementine and Lee are such blank slates that you're really free to, like, craft them to be whoever you want them to be, I feel like. Whereas, you know, all these Foresters, you definitely have the ability to make them who you want. But I guess I know so much about Game of Thrones, because, I've read all the books and I've watched the show, that I want to create versions of them that I think have a chance of like living in the world, in the Martin universe. I'm not necessarily playing them the way that I would do things as much as I'm playing them as what would I do if I were this figure living in George R.R. Martin's world. So, but you know, I also see why you're playing the way you are, because you know, you're playing as an entire family, so it seems logical to try and coordinate your efforts to have the best results for the whole family. All right, so what's the second choice, Trev?
Second choice is dealing with Roderick and kissing Lord Whitehill's ring when he barges in on your little
kiss his ring.
You did or didn't?
I did not kiss his...
I hesitated. This is the hardest decision I think I made it the whole game. I was like, what benefit...
Oh, this one was really easy for me, actually. This was one of the easier decisions.
I wasn't sure how to do this one because I was like, I don't know... the long play here, you know? It was like...
Right, that's you know, and that's one of the interesting things about this franchise, is that, at least compared to The Walking Dead, it seems like, because, you know, we've both read the books and we watched the show, that we are intimately aware of how much one seemingly insignificant decision can have these, you know, crazy long-term effects.
Yeah, so I ended up kissing his ring, because I was like, you know what? Conflict is not what I need right now in this house. So let's just kiss the ring and get him out, and then get my brother back for at least the funeral.
I kept his men drunk, and I told him to. I basically told him to fuck off.
No, I eventually said.
I mean, I did.
I said that too.
I didn't say fuck off because, like, if the option had been kiss his ring or he like injures my little brother, then I would have done it. If it's like kiss my ring or my little brother doesn't get to go to his brother's and dad's funeral, no, Ryan'll get by. That choice wasn't hard for me.
The outcome was the same. I still lost all my land.
Right, we still end up losing all of our land.
Dick.
Were you able to convince Elena to be your betrothed still?
That was the next topic here. And no.
Neither.
I was doing so well. She was like, oh, she appreciates your humor. She appreciates your honesty. I was like, okay, we're doing good. We're doing good. And then I don't know what happened. It's just like all of a sudden, it's like, nope, no, can't do this. Maybe I wasn't firm enough.
Yeah, I think that that's interesting because I think that all the choices that make her like you as a person are the things that make her not want to marry you.
Well, no, I was thinking about what his mother said. Like, you need to, you know... basically
woo
her, but also you gotta be firm with her. You gotta do both. I was like, and I don't think I was firm enough.
Yeah, so well, we both failed there.
Well,
there are two more choices.
55% of the players lost the betrayal. So
how many percent?
55%. So
yeah, that's what it was for me. I think it said 75. I'm like, I didn't realize it was that big, but yeah, I was one of the parts that lost the betrothal. So the next one then is about the knife, or is that the last one?
No, the next one's about Carter and Finn's stolen knife. Yeah,
yeah. I did not rat him out.
We are in the super majority there. 95% of the people.
Yeah, it was like 92%.
And it makes sense. I mean, once again, this is us almost meta playing the scenario because we know what the North is about.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely fair.
And we
and then the final one was. Which I'm guessing that we were both also in the majority for, was did you kill Mira's attacker?
Yeah, we were both in the majority there. 93% killed whoever that guy was.
Yeah, so clearly, you know, who... Cersei, right, had is having her killed? Or is it going to turn out to be Margaery? Because that would be a real twist.
I think it's Cersei because of who she's lying herself with is Tyrion, so it has to be Cersei. Right.
Yeah.
who else be that evil?
That's fair. Cersei is really one of the worst people on that whole show.
I can't wait for season 5 because this is going to be Cersei's season.
Yeah, I mean, well, George Martin says that lots of stuff is going to be happening that's not in the books.
I know, but this is still Cersei's season to shine in terms of character development and storyline.
Right. Well, I guess we only have like 10 minutes left. Less than that. We've been talking for 55 minutes now. So let's move on to the secret sauce for what little time we have left. I'm going to start this one off real quick. Watch Broad City, people.
Just
That's
the shortest review you'll ever get from Don Charles.
Like, it's so good. I don't binge watch TV shows. I hate that. because I like to sit, like, for the most part, I want to, like, take my time and really enjoy them. Broad City was so good that I watched the entirety of it in less than a week on Hulu. That said, there's only, like, a season and a half. It's still on. Like, it's in the beginning of its second season right now on TV. It's so good. It's one of the few shows, it might be the only show that I feel like really captures what it's like to be in your early 20s in the 2010s. It's very much a how we live now show. If how we live now is two constantly stoned millennials, 20-something girls, it's really fun. But it's also really sincere in a weird way, despite how absurd and surrealist it can be. So I'm a big fan of that show. You should watch it. I am sad that I've already watched all of it because I wish there was more. There's an episode on this newest season. You know, I don't want to spoil it because it's so ridiculous that it's one of those shows that is both ridiculous but also really sincere, and that's like the hardest gap to bridge in writing is to come off as like crazy but also like heartfelt, and Broad City does that. So also just as a millennial in his mid 20s, it's rare to see my generation portrayed remotely accurately on television. Trevor, how about Ken Burns' The Civil War?
Oh, so that's the one you want to talk about. It's not Thor. You don't want to talk about Thor?
No, let's not talk about Thor.
Okay.
Thor sucks. There we go. We talked about Thor.
Wasn't very good. The only reason I watched because, you know, I feel like I have to before The Avengers comes out. Well, the Ken Burns Civil War, it's a great little documentary to do other things at the same time because there's not really much watching involved. It's a Ken Burns documentary. If people understand that statement, I hope they do, because it's basically just, you know, interviews and then pictures and voiceovers. That's literally...
That is the Ken Burns method.
Which is a very effective method, so it's really good at what it does. And it was really enlightening. The only really Civil War studying I ever did was, you know, whatever American history I took in high school and college. Not anything particularly dedicated to Civil War, but, you know, the general stuff. So I learned a lot, actually. A lot more.
Yeah, I mean, Ken Burns' documentaries are always really good that way. He has one about the Second World War that's also really good.
Which is also on Netflix. That'll probably be the next thing I do when I walk on my stained glass.
Yeah, I watched... like over half of that when I was prepping for my World War II screenplay. Huh. So Ken Burns he's good at what he does. I'm not saying that he makes the most exciting things on the planet. It's literally like voiceovers and pictures. That's the Ken Burns way. Occasionally, if it's about something more recent, he might have interviews.
Yeah, he had interviews in the Civil War one.
Okay, see, I haven't seen the Civil War.
Yeah, no, he has interviews, and sometimes those interviews are voiced over. But yeah, no, he still has actual footage of interviews. So,
well, there you go. So Ken Burns is for fuck's sake, he's like the grandfather of long form documentary filmmaking in America. So,
I mean, even
he's the most
even Community made an episode dedicated to him. Come on.
They did. They made an entire episode
Pillows and Blankets.
Pillows and Blankets. It's a classic episode. Watch Community, people. It should be starting its final season on Yahoo soon. That's the fucking crazy ass world that we live in these days.
Yeah, Yahoo's
that a show can be on NBC for 5 years and constantly be on the verge of cancellation. Be canceled, come back to NBC for a season or two, and then finally get canceled for good, and then come back as a show on Yahoo. We live in the we're science fiction now.
Yeah, that's probably not a good thing for the show either.
No, it's not. It's not good for the show. It's like constant cast changes, constantly never knowing if you're going to be on TV anymore. I mean, the only good thing about like if you think you're going to get canceled. Like, if you're convinced you're going to get canceled, you can at least, you know, go for complete broke on you know, being as fucking I don't give a fuck as you want when it comes to, like, you know, how you put your show together. Arrested Development definitely showed strands of that in its final season. And on that note, we are out of time. We've been talking for an hour now. Next week, for this week's Hot Sauce, we will be discussing All the Real Girls, starring Zooey Deschanel and Paul Schneider.
He means Digging Deep for people that are confused.
Did I say the wrong thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for this week's Hot Sauce, we'll be talking about the third and fourth episodes of Better Call Saul.
Yes! I watched that episode last night. So good.
I'm going to watch it. I'm probably going to watch it tonight. And then for the secret sauce, we'll figure that out. I've been playing a lot of Assassin's Creed Black Flag, and I just bought Dragon Age Inquisition for like a really crazy cheap sale. So maybe I'll have something to say about it too. And on that note, Trevor, see us out.
You can always find us on Twitter at Sauce Perspective. You can also find us on Facebook. You can like us there and, you know, communicate with us that way. You can find us on iTunes. You can just search the Sauce Perspective, and we should be the first thing that pops up. there aren't that many things with the name Sauce in them on iTunes. Other than podcasts about software as services. not many people get that joke. That's okay.
All right. Well, have a great week, everybody.
Take care.